So hi and welcome to the Movies You Love podcast, a podcast where every week I get to sit down and talk. Well, I shouldn't say every week, because we technically do this every 2 weeks. Am I messing up the intro already? That's generally a thing I do here. I sit down and talk with an interesting writer or just general film lover about the movie that helped him or her fall in love with films. And this week we have on the very interesting Mr. Merrill Barr, writer and contributor and generally always doing things on the internet over at Forbes.com as well as Nerdist.com. And he has asked us to discuss one of the more interesting or out of the box kind of picks that have been discussed on this show, and it is the 2003 Joel Schumacher classic Phone Booth. Now, if you ever thought there was someone out there who loved films like this and you just couldn't comprehend, you've never spoken to Merrill Barr, because he is that guy. And I'm sure many people have said that in a way of begrudgment towards Merrill, but I say it in friendship, because I adore his little weird own interpretation of film and media and enjoyment, and we get into a lot of that within this discussion about the film. So I'm not even going to try and keep this intro going, because I think I might have messed up at least 5 times so far, and say enjoy this episode. It's kind of a really good conversation, and yeah, see you on the other side.
New York City, 12 million people, 22 million phones, a billion connections a day.
I believe in you, man. Big Q, be reasonable.
I'm a gangster. I don't gotta be reasonable.
Cutting out. Hello,
Big Q. You keep talking about.
Stu Shepard thought he had the game wired.
How's business? Tickets. 4 for Britney Spears, right?
No, you owe me, Stu.
It's gotta be the night of the 18th, and I will deliver you a truckload of celebrities.
But today, someone's got his number.
Yeah.
Don't even think about leaving that booth.
Wrong number, pal.
I'm aiming at you right now. Can
so,
you feel it?
Merrill, you...
Yes.
You're here to talk about the 2000...
My favorite movie of all time, yes. Yes,
your
yes,
favorite
yes.
movie of all time.
Yes.
Joel
no,
Schumacher
this is not... This is Phone Booth. Hang on, let's backtrack a little bit. I'm not saying that Joel Schumacher is a fantastic director. In fact, most of his recent material, in fact, every movie pretty much after this movie has been downhill. And okay. It was downhill before this movie. Like, he has – it's, you know, like, just like sometimes people get lucky. That's pretty much what's happened here. Like, he got lucky one time and it really worked out and ended up being the best movie I've ever seen. But like it really or one of the best things I've ever seen, but it's my favorite. We'll get into why. But it really just goes downhill, man.
I'm gonna say, because I like the idea of stretching this out even further, you're gonna be a first here by being the first person to preemptively attempt to defend his movie before I've even mentioned the movie's name. But let's not even go there. But the movie you've asked us to discuss today is a 2003 film directed by Joel Schumacher, that being Phone Booth. And I think you...
I just know where this is going. I've gone through this so many times already.
I know. It sounds like you, more than any of my guests, have gotten used to the idea of having to defend this movie every time it comes
it's
up
not
in
even,
conversation.
It's not, but it's not like... But here's the thing. It's not that I'm defending it against people who think it's bad. A lot of people think at the very least, I get a lot of, oh yeah, I like that movie, it's pretty good. But everyone, it's not so much the shock of, oh yeah, I like that movie too. It's the shock of, wait, that's that? Like, it's such an out there for people choice, where they're like, why the, like in the pantheon of film, you know, and you're thinking about the great films, Citizen Kane and, Reservoir Dogs and Star Wars and Lawrence of Arabia, and you know, just think about the pantheon of great films, nowhere on the list, and you could go down the thousands of films and you would never stumble on Joel Schumacher's Phone Booth, which I totally get, but there's reasons why that movie just hits me the way it does.
And I'm sure we're going to be getting into those reasons. But before we start there, I have to start with the simple question that everyone begins with on this show. And that's me asking, tell me something about the first time you actually sat down to see this film. I'm going to assume this was a theatrical viewing for you.
No, that's
no, it wasn't.
Thing. No, that's the thing. Is I discovered this movie. I was homesick from school, right? Yeah, I was homesick from school. And I think it was in high school at this point. Yes, I was in high school. And the TV, you know, at this point, the movie had got well. We were well past theatrical. We were well past even like premium. I mean, it was at the point where it was cycling through network cable, you know? I mean, so this is probably 2005, 2006. And I was home from school, and FX used to have, I think they swapped it out for something else, but they used to have this thing called TV on DVD on TV. So it was one of those movie wraparound shows where they play a movie, and then when they cut to commercial break, they cut to some guys in a studio, and they kind of do a thing about the movie, or in this case, their thing was they would show you the DVD special features on TV. So they would show you some of the making of featurettes and shit. It was really good. By the way, am I allowed to curse?
Go right ahead.
Sweet. So they would show all that stuff. So that's where I actually came into it about halfway into the movie the first time. Like they were up to the scene like right after Forrest Whitaker and his squad of cops had just shown up.
Okay.
So this is after you know you meet the sniper. This is after Stu Cyber shoots the dude and Stu gets blamed for it. So we're well into the movie at this point.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's just like something about Forrest Whitaker yelling into the bullhorn to try and talk to Stu and through all this confusion and understand what's happened. And I had a slight idea of the movie because I did remember trailers for it from when it came out in 2003. But it was never like on my radar. And I just remember watching it being like, I'm in. And this is at the time when I was still kind of watching movies on television. Like I didn't do it that much, but that was my first instance of it. And I just remember being like, I am deeply interested in what's happening right now. I don't know who's who and what anyone's names are. At that point, I didn't know, you know, Raimi and Stu and all that stuff, but like it's just something about just watching them just, and it was weird because it's like action without action. There's no actual action in that. I mean, there's the pimp who tries to get into the phone booth with a baseball bat, and he immediately gets shot by a sniper we never see until the very, very end. There's no gunplay, which is my thing because I'm a huge Michael Bay fan. There's no explosions. It's just dudes talking. And something about them talking and the way they did it and the pace that it happened at, something about that was just hitting me the right way that first time.
So at this point in time, you weren't much of the thriller knowledge fanatic moving in.
Right.
Because that's what this movie plays off completely to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, that not at all. And when I started doing research into the movie later, after I had decided, okay, this is the movie, right? This is the movie. If this is my answer to the question, what's your favorite movie? It's this movie. When I started doing research, that's when I learned, you know, Larry Cohen, who wrote the movie, he actually pitched the idea originally to Alfred Hitchcock in the late days of his career. He said, "What if we do a movie completely set in a phone booth?" And Hitchcock wanted to do it, but they couldn't figure out how to keep the dude in the phone booth. And then he finally figured out, he's like, and then around the early 90s, he's like, sniper. And he's like, okay, great. So, okay, that's how we keep it in the phone booth. And he started sending it around. Actually, Michael Bay was even up for the job to direct it. And his first words in the meeting were, okay, how do we get the dude out of the phone booth? And that's where Larry Cohen said, okay, it's not him. And actually, it's a great decision. Because this movie with Michael Bay attached would have been a completely different movie. It probably wouldn't be my favorite movie, but I think it just has to do with you have to think about where everyone was. This is Joel Schumacher. This is either his first movie right after Batman and Robin or something.
No, there was another movie in between.
Tigerland.
I was looking at the other day. Yeah, Tigerland. Because
Tigerland.
That's a movie
Tigerland.
That I've heard of lots of good things of, but I still haven't yet to watch. And I remember, like the other day, I was looking through a lot of reviews at the time of Phone Booth, trying to see what people thought of it then, because I know what people think of it now to a certain extent.
They say the opinion nearly hasn't changed. They're like, it's fun, it's good, it's a good time. It's not, you know, the high class cinema, which I disagree with. But it's, if I didn't disagree with that, it wouldn't be my favorite movie. But it's like, you know, no one has this grand opinion. No one hates it. No one loves it. It's just, for most people, it just kind of exists in the middle. It's this 90, it's like 90, 89 minute movie. It just kind of, it's there and it's done. It exists in this time and space and it's over. And it also, when you think about the time it came out, this movie actually got pushed back. It was supposed to come out, I think, in 2002, but that was when the DC sniper situation was happening, so they ended up pushing the movie into 2003. So it did have a little relevancy at the time it came out. I mean, you don't live in the US, so I don't know if you remember.
I'm definitely aware of the DC sniper, because it became a big thing here, because they found out that the sniper was of Jamaican descent, and it became a big thing where Jamaica came under even more scrutiny in people attempting to immigrate towards the US, which is still an issue. God damn it, America, can't I come over and say hi to my friends every once in a while? But even when you see, I think there's been this thing where almost there are at least four or five huge criminal incidents, terrorist criminal incidents within the States where, oh my goodness, the person came up of Jamaican descent. And I remember there was this point in time where we would hear news of something going on in America and we just started saying to ourselves, please don't be Jamaican. Please don't be Jamaican. Because we were just tired of it being blamed on us for some reason. Because even if the person lived in Jamaica for one day of their life, it became became our fault immediately for some reason.
Solid. Solid.
But yeah, I do remember that, and now that you mentioned it, I never thought of them being interconnected, because I think the first time I ever remembered an event being connected to, like, a film and its delaying or whatever happened to be was the London train bombings and V for Vendetta. I think that's the first that I can remember
By the way, I'm not saying the theatrical release of Phone Booth came and went for me. I never had any.
This is also
2003, so I wasn't really seeing R-rated movies at that point. That's the other thing. This is an R-rated movie where it's R-rated for language, but there's next to no violence to make it R-rated. It's solely because Stu says fuck a lot. That's it.
But like, when you were watching it for the first time, he would probably be saying suck and duck a lot. So
because it was it was an FX TV edit at 2 p.m. But that was the first time I saw it, and then what happened was, I remember I watched it and I was like, that was cool. Something about the way they did it and the split screens and all that stuff, which would then be even more parallel to me when I then got into 24, which stars Kiefer Sutherland, who plays the sniper, and it'd be like, and I think that's where I slowly started to make this is well after I viewed it a few times. Where I slowly started to make the connection as to why it was working for me, where I was like, okay, the thing that what was cool about it, and when I started figuring it out, was this movie takes place once from the moment Stu gets on the phone and gets in the phone booth to the end of the movie. That's all real time, and at no point do we jump forward or back in time, and that's it. Now there's a little forward jumping in time before the phone booth, so we can get sort of the setup of who he is. But after that, it just goes. So I think he gets to the phone booth at the 10-minute mark. So pretty much from the 10-minute mark on, it's a movie that plays out in real time, which is fantastic. And the way he sort of, Schumacher would make sure to like always keep us in the phone booth if they were talking, but if there's any downtime, it's not like we spent in the phone booth just with him in silence. He would go like, okay, let's jump over and see what the cops are doing. Let's jump over and see what the news crews are doing. Let's go jump over and see what's happening with his wife and sort of not girlfriend. Like, there's a lot of stuff happening at once, and sometimes he would show that through split screen, which is sometimes considered fairly cheesy in movies because split screen doesn't usually look that good. But for this, it kind of worked because it kind of felt like a news broadcast when he was doing that. It's like news broadcasts do split screen all the time, and he does in this movie, and it really works. But after that first initial viewing, I not immediately, it was a couple days after, I was like, I kind of want to watch that movie from the beginning. So I went and I ordered the movie through my cable on demand service. And this is when it was, you know, still 4:3 standard definition. So I wasn't even getting that whole experience. But I turned it on and just watched it being like, this is fascinating. Again, you know, this is 2005, 2006. I don't understand I don't have any understanding of why I like it so much. I just know that it's hitting me in a way that I wasn't getting hit through most things. I have sometimes have experiences watching Terminator or The Rock or Bad Boys or T2, a lot of James Cameron, Michael Bay stuff, John Woo films, Mission Impossible 2 would do that for some reason. I like that movie, just not as much anymore. But this movie stayed consistent, and I would keep finding, and the point I'm getting to is there gets to a point where I started to realize every time I would watch the movie, I'd find one more little thing to make me like it more. And the big one that did it was, it's the scene where the sniper first reveals that he has a rifle, yeah. Not that he's watching through binoculars. And Stu's like, fuck off, dude. And then the sniper just pulls the pin on the rifle. And it goes click, click, click. And you see Stu's face go from ha to, oh, fuck me. It's just this small moment. And you just watch his facial expression in the best of ways just go from a smiling douchebaggery to, oh, I'm about to die. I've never seen anyone pull it off as well as Colin Farrell does in that moment since. But there's just something about that and the way the sound is edited, because it's a very loud click, click, click on the rifle. And it's just like so weird. And when they did the sound design, they slightly echoed the bullet coming out of the chamber of the rifle. So it's like click, 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 and it echoes into the score. And all those things at once just bring it to like, oh my God. And it just really got to me. And this is on TV again. I've never seen this movie theatrically, and I really want to experience it in a theater. And it's just, I don't think that's ever going to happen unless I, you know, control a theater at some point.
Well, you know, I'm sure there are ways to do that. But I'm kind of curious, thinking about this and thinking a little bit about how much I know about you and your writing, in that you have become more well-known for your writing about television and talking about the television experience. This film feeling, in even a lot of the films you're kind of mentioning in surrounding what we're talking about, feeling more of an episodic adventure rather than anything else. Did that have anything to do with how you move forward in your love of not just film, but as media, that you ended up in that TV world of discussion?
Well, I like the fast-paced world of TV. Like a three-hour movie, unless it's really good, doesn't do it for me. You know, a two-and-a-half-hour movie sometimes stretches the limit, even if it's directed by Michael Bay. Even a two-hour, like, you know, there's just something about, like, I'm happy to sit through your three-hour movie if it's worth sitting through 3 hours of. But if at any point I'm like, I could pull, like, if any point I go, I can pull 30 minutes out of this and it'd be a better movie, you know, then the movie kind of falls apart for me. Phone Booth sort of does this thing where it only gives you what you need to know, plus a tiny bit more, it's very quick. It goes by in a flash, which is cool because I imagine that's kind of how it's going down. Like when you see stuff like what happens in Phone Booth, not that anyone's ever been held by a sniper rifle in a phone booth, but there have, you know, there's plenty of news stories where, you know, breaking news or hostage situations or all that stuff. And it's why I gravitate to that show Flashpoint later on in life. Cause it's like, it if you're watching it from the perspective of the news, it goes, you know, it happens and then it's done. Like when the whole here, all right, I'm in California now, right? There was a big thing last year with this crazy cop named Dorner. And he, so I forgot his first name, his last name is Dorner. And he basically was on a rampage and he spent like 18 days on the run. Or maybe it was less than that. But something like they spent a fair amount of time on the run. And then they got to the day where they finally found him in the woods. And it went from, in a matter of hours, it went from they found him to his house is on fire and he's burning alive. And it happened so fast. Like there was no real downtime with it. And that's kind of how Phone Booth feels, where it's like I was watching this from the perspective of a viewer, which I am because I'm watching the movie. It happens and then it's over. The news crews show up. And actually, if you look at the runtime, the news crews are only ever there for about 40 minutes, and then they're gone because it takes them that long to first get the call, like oh shit, something's going down, then respond to it. And by the end of the movie, Stu is all over the map. He's on every channel. You know, the sniper has made him famous. And then, you know, it ends and then it's over. And we never see Stu get interviewed. We never see news crews sort of – all the news crews want to do is cover the phone booth. You kind of see it in the last shot when the sniper's walking through. All the news crews care about is covering that phone booth. And then you have that one moment where Adam, who's Stu's assistant – in the beginning of the movie, he goes to talk to Pam, who's played by Tom Cruise's ex-wife. I forgot her name.
Katie Holmes.
Katie Holmes. She's played by Katie Holmes. And so he goes up to her saying like, yo, I can make you famous. So basically, Adam, Stu's assistant, learned nothing, implying he might be the sniper's next target. And then you have Stu's fixed relationship with his wife. Kelly. And it's just, you know, all of that stuff just comes together brilliantly for me because I look at that and I'm like, yeah, if I was watching this in real life, I would watch it. You know, imagine now in Twitter land, the story would break. It would take the news crews about 5 more minutes to get cameras onto the scene because this is New York City, so they'd probably get there fairly quickly. And then I'd just watch it. And then, you know, it would happen. And then from the perspective of – you got to think about the movie from the perspective of someone watching the news where it'd be like, okay, where they're watching, then boom, Stu runs out of the phone booth with a gun and then from their perspective just gets shot. They don't know what happened. And you got to remember, from the news crews have no idea there's a sniper. That's just something only the cops know. Yeah. So from the perspective of a viewer – he ran out and the cop shot him. And then, you know, and then I'm sure if we were to follow this movie past that point, it'd be like slowly it would come out. There was a sniper they think it's the pizza man, which is a whole other thing about this movie I want to get into. Just like, you know, that's where you would assume that goes. But for that moment, it kind of works like a news breaking news story, which is, it happens, it's over, and then most people turn off the channel at that point because they okay, he got shot. I guess that's it, and then they turn off the – yeah, that's kind of how I imagine the perspective of a viewer watching any of that news coverage for that event.
Yeah, but I mean with every news coverage, there's always the follow-up. For something like that, you would see that night the nightly discussion topic being they finally got him on the news to sit down and talk about the experience.
I have a real suspicion that Stu, based on the way the movie plays out, Stu would be very adamant to not go on the news, Raimi would to explain what happened.
Yeah.
I see that happening.
But I mean, if it's not him, it would be they would have that 15-minute block in the evening news where the captain would help explain the other five elements, which now that everything is cleared up, like, yeah, we can talk about that. And stuff like that. So when we're talking about things like experiencing the news when it comes to these kind of events happening, we're also forgetting the post-analysis, which is something that most films actually go into in their own ways. where if it was another film, you would have had that fast forward last 15 minutes where they go 2 weeks later and you'd see the new
news. That's what's fascinating. Or they do it in the credits or something. They would play it out during the credits. But that's what's fascinating about this movie and thinking about where Joel Schumacher was, where, you know, the wounds of Batman and Robin are still very recent at the time of this movie. You know, it's Tigerland and this. And then I, you know, again, haven't seen Tigerland, but here it's really good. Where I think he was just trying to be as low-key as possible. Like, how low-key can I get to – how do I avoid going over the top? And this is when Colin Farrell was first breaking out. He still hadn't completely broken out yet as a major star. And, you know, they could bill him, but, you know, they could bill him in Forrest Whitaker, but they weren't names. They were just starting to become names at this point. But Joel Schumacher is just like, he went so low key with it, which is why it's so weird to, like, watch this movie and be like, who directed this again? That guy? The Lost Boys dude directed this? Okay. And it's like, I like Lost Boys. I don't love Lost Boys, you know? I like I forgot the name of the movie, but it was a movie about – it's Starkeeper Sutherland also, and it was about death. And they figure out how to, like, go into death and then come out of it, and how long can you keep someone dead for. I forgot what it was called.
I have no clue what you're talking about.
It's like right after Lost Boys. But okay. Something like that, and then it's like, you know, Batman and Robin, like, and Batman Forever, and it's like, that guy made that movie? It's such not a movie. Like, you think about Joel Schumacher, you think about the movies of Joel Schumacher. Nothing about this movie. Like, also, the thing about Joel Schumacher is, especially leading up to Batman and Robin, and at Batman and Robin, it's always very sex-filled. Just a lot of metaphors, or sometimes not metaphors, for sex in his movies. He just kind of – and all kinds of relationships, you know. There's, you know, there's a lot of homoeroticism in The Lost Boys. There's a lot of that in his Batman movies. But, like, this movie, nothing. I mean, there's the stuff with the strippers, but that's just life on the streets of that part of New York City. I mean, it's just – and it's so cool how – the other that's cool thing about it is this whole movie takes place in the – like in the it's either like late morning or the middle of the afternoon. I mean, nothing. It's he shot the city in that way where if you're ever in New York City during the night, you know, like in like many cities at night, it opens up, it becomes cool and bright and neons and colorful. And but during the day, you know, it's this mute bluish tone. Sometimes if it's gray outside, sometimes if it's bright, it's just hot and icky. And see, that's how he shot the city. He didn't shoot the city all slick and cool. Like, it's very dirty. And it's kind of interesting because it's like that's what New York City looks like in the middle of the day. Now, he shot this in Los Angeles, but the same idea. You get the point was got across, which is, you know, in the middle of the day, nothing about this is fun. And he kind of got the – like, this is nothing – like, everything he could to get across, this isn't fun for Stu. This isn't fun for Raimi. There's nothing to – enjoy about this, but there's even though I know just that movie really hits me like in that way.
Yeah. When you're talking about films like this, and I think you kind of brought it up on your with what you were saying about the movie being such a tightly placed movie where everything has to stay so focused that if anything just feels out of place, it kind of just exponentially feels wrong within the movie, and it'll throw the viewer out of place. When you watch movies, you said if you feel a movie could lose 20 minutes, you're already done with the movie. You're already.
I mean, I'm not done, ready but like. I'm not done, but it's like it definitely won't go, you know, it's not going to hit any favorites list. For example, all right, I'll give you an example. Transformers 3, Michael Bay, love that movie. I love Michael Bay, and that movie's pretty good. But I'm telling you, he could have dropped 30 minutes from the first hour and a half, and just the faster – if he had gotten us to Chicago, which is the last hour of the movie, If he had gotten us to Chicago way faster and just pulled 30 minutes, which he could easily have done, out of that first hour and a half that leads up to the big Chicago battle, I would have loved that movie. But as it stands now, the movie's just kind of bloated, you know? It's a little too much, you know? Like that, and that's what I'm – or Dark Knight Rises, taking a more popular example. Dark Knight Rises is the same thing. I like the Dark Knight Rises. I'm not – a lot of people are down on it. I like it. But what keeps it from being as awesome as The Dark Knight is it's too much. Like there's just too much movie. And it just there's stuff that should have been cut out.
No. I'm with you for the most part, at least in that Dark Knight Rises bit. Because, I mean, I have issues with that movie. I enjoy it, but there are still some things which systematically make me want to step away from it more than I will say other movies from that year, which is why it wasn't a movie which hit like my favorite list of the year kind of film. But pulling back to Phone Booth and these tightly wound movies, like what is it? Are there these kind of films or even this kind of television where they become so tightly wound and so perfectly constructed that they maybe hit perfection too well and it kind of lets something else show wrong in the form itself for you?
Well, there's definitely like if you're really into something and it's so like everything has its purpose and then something pops up that isn't that all right, I'll take it to Flashpoint, which is this, if you've never seen, anyone who's never seen it, and a lot of people haven't, especially if you're from the States, it's a Canadian cop show aired on CBS.
Which you've been nagging me to watch forever, and I still haven't.
It's on Netflix, Andrew.
I will one day.
But it's about this SWAT team called the SRU, and the big hook in their design is while they are a SWAT team, they also specialize in psychoanalysis, and so their big thing is they get into people's heads and they try to negotiate them down. The whole hook is they don't want to go tactical. They want very much to end a crisis by talking it out, by getting creative, by not sort of going to this last resort of lethal force, which is a big thing, especially in American media and just American police work in general. Is just in America, it's how do we end this as quickly as possible? And the answer to that is, well, we shoot someone. In this Canadian mindset, it was, okay, how do we end this as cleanly as possible? Meaning, you know, how do we end this with fewest shots fired? And that's sort of the idea of Flashpoint. And so especially in the first two seasons, all of that show is pretty much fantastic, minus like one episode. But then as it went on, there was definitely like an episode in season three that just didn't fit. Because the way the show worked was kind of like Phone Booth is all the episodes pretty much take place in this 3 to 5 hour window. That's the episode. That's our story. And then we don't kind of go past that. And it's like back when it was really beginning, they would start an episode in the middle of the crisis. They show you something and then they'd rewind to how we got there and then show you a little bit past that point. And that point that we see is the quote unquote Flashpoint, in science being when there's a fire, the flashpoint is where something can ignite. Yeah. And that's the idea. It's like that moment, that's your flashpoint. And that's where, you know, shit's about to hit the fan. And so there's definitely there are a couple episodes of Flashpoint that take place over the course of like 12 hours and it doesn't work because especially for one of them I got to this point where I was like, they shouldn't be working this anymore. They're a SWAT team. Like, there's a point where once the crisis ends, once the immediate crisis is over, their job is done and it should be handed off to detectives, you know, to do their jobs. So there's definitely times where it didn't work all the way. But that idea, or 24, take it to a popular example. 24, especially the early days of 24 were like that. You know, every episode was this tightly wound thing where, you know, every episode takes place in real time. So if we were seeing something, we were seeing it because we had to see it. We weren't seeing it to fill time because there's no time to fill. Because, you know, any hour we're spending, any minute or second we're spending away from Jack Bauer and spending it with someone else, Jack is still doing something. Like, that's the thing about real time is if Jack is driving somewhere and we cut away, That means Jack is still driving somewhere in that in the universe of that show. You understand? Like, yeah. So that's why, and that's why we cut away from Jack, is because we don't need to see him. Then we might spend like 20 minutes away from Jack because it's going to take him that long to drive somewhere in Los Angeles. Like, and so we would just keep seeing stuff that we need to see. And like, that's, it's again, to bring it back to Phone Booth. That's the idea of, if there was no talk, if Stu and the sniper weren't talking, we didn't spend time with Stu and the sniper because we don't need to see him not talking, you know? And I think there would be movies that would just what let us spend, have us spend time in the phone booth of silence and just watch Stu kind of quote unquote stew, you know, just kind of sit there and just wonder. But we don't need to see that. We know, we get it. You know, he thinks he's going to die. We don't need to see all the silent moments between him and the sniper, which there surely are.
But the thing about that, though, is that not so much that we're losing time because we can't since we're staying in real time, but the question is how do you fill the time that isn't there in the first place, for where there would traditionally be edits when it comes to films and conversations. Like, I would feel sometimes that we were being handed off to Forrest Whitaker and the police, and it's something that comes out of traditional trope film, especially when it comes to police, that we'd end up with police who, because they weren't part of the real solution for the most part, they were always dumb police, and they just felt like lost time within the movie. Where, and I think it's my favorite part of this movie, and only because it made me laugh the most. Because, I mean, this is a movie where some people are going to laugh at it more than they're laughing with it sometimes.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And I give this movie more credit than some do when it comes to being an enjoyable thriller. But there's this point in the movie where, and as I describe it to people, the police have come to this situation, assuming that Stu is the bad guy, as all they can assume at this point.
And I just spin off that for a minute. That's the thing, though, is they aren't, like, there are movies where the cops are dumb.
Yeah.
Here, it's not that they're dumb. They don't have all the facts. And a lot of their story is about trying to understand what's happened.
No. And I understand that for most storytelling. And for this film specifically, there are points where it works as they are trying to figure out where the situation is. But it still becomes laughable at certain points in their protocol usage. And it might just be my lack of knowledge of New York police work or whatnot. But there's this point, and as I said, they've come and they don't know much other than they believe Stu is the guy who's murdered this individual. We see Stu in the phone booth. They believe he has a gun. Their solution is, I want snipers on the roofs. And I can't stop but laugh. Like,
how does
that help anyone?
In my mind, it was like, it's when he says that, I imagine it's just to get someone on the roof, because there was later in the movie, if you remember, and this goes back to why we only are told things that are important, is because later in the movie, one of the dudes with binoculars, one of the scouts, actually sees Stu, quote unquote, pull a small dark object out of his pocket, which the cops think is a gun, which is actually his phone, because he's trying to get on the call with his wife to alert his wife what's happening. And so having the snipers on the roofs is more, I think, just so they can get as bulls. Because basically the idea is they need every angle they can on Stu, because if Stu pulls a gun, they need to move. Like, if they see Stu pull a gun, someone's got to yell gun. So they need every angle of that phone booth covered, because they don't want this dude – they don't know what's up with this guy. They don't understand what's happening. They don't understand why he has stuck around after killing this dude. So as far as they know, he's insane, and insane people need to be watched. And so that's why they sort of like snipers on the roofs, dudes on the corner, dudes on a balcony, dudes by the cop car, because they don't know what's up. They're like, I mean, this is to, if we're saying this movie takes place in our world. So this is New York City 2 years after 9/11. They don't know what's up. Like, as far as, for all they know, this dude is some crazy suicide bomber that was going to commit something and then got cold feet and now is on the phone. I feel like I can't do this. And so, you know, like, they don't know. That's a big reason. Like, they don't know the situation. So in my head, when they go, snipers on the roofs, that totally works for me. Because I'm like, yeah, you would get snipers on the roofs because you have no idea what's going down right now.
Yeah. But, alright, thinking about this movie and thinking about your love for this movie, I'm kind of curious. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the... I'm curious how much your love for this movie grew over the years, not just because of the movie itself, but because of the conversations that came from this movie, where, you were instantly always on some form of a defensive form.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely a factor. If I walked into a room, here's the thing. If your favorite movie is a movie that is either, like, if it's bad, if someone's favorite movie is a movie that's legitimately considered bad, then there's kind of no conversation. Because it's like, okay, I can't even, because the people will be like, I can't even talk to you. If your favorite movie is something that's considered traditionally a classic or good. So if someone walks into a room and say, like, I got a friend who's a history major, whose favorite movie is Lawrence of Arabia. No one's going to argue with the dude who loves Lawrence of Arabia, you know? But when I walk into a room and say, my favorite movie is Phone Booth, that's instantly a conversation because no one can wrap their brains around it. Like, there are definitely ways you can wrap your brain around someone's favorite movie being a horrible movie. And they can wrap your brain around, of course, someone's favorite movie being a classic. But they can't wrap their brain around someone's favorite movie being a movie that is widely considered average. That's the thing about Phone Booth. But critical consensus says it's average. It's there. You know, it's nothing special. It just is. It's this fun. It's this 90-minute thing. Take it or leave it. There's nothing astounding about it. But whenever I see that movie, so that's why, I definitely think that when it's being discussed, people instantly want to know where my head's at when I think that, and then, you know, and so already I'm in this much longer conversation than most people would be in, and then I do kind of have to go on the defensive because they're like, don't you just, it's just kind of, you know, why would you pick that? And I don't know why I picked that. It's just my brain went to that, you know, just the way that movie plays out. And I'm always, ever since then, I've always looked for movies like that. Like, there's a Chris Evans movie called Cellular, which runs on, and it actually came out the same year. And it runs, And it's not, I mean, it's not great. Like, that to me is average, where it definitely goes, where it doesn't, it gets silly. It definitely gets silly at points where, you know, and it goes to all the places where Phone Booth threatens to go, but never actually goes. Like, Phone Booth takes its premise very seriously. Like, okay, if there was a dude in a phone booth and he had killed someone, what would the response be? And that would be, at the very least on the local level, it'd be a major news story. It'd be a major thing with the cops. Like Cellular is like, it gets so, like, there's a point where the woman being held hostage is just kind of working the phone in her phone, which has been destroyed. And she's kind of just clicking wires and hot wiring the phone. And it's like, I don't know how the hell this is supposed to make sense.
I remember that movie. I remember watching it on television sometime after. And I remember thinking, oh, it was one of those movies which it just kind of entertained me for the time being, right? And then I remember seeing it on TV. I've forgotten about it forever. I saw it on TV recently, only to just realize it was Chris Evans in that movie. And it just threw for a loop. When you're talking about movies like Phone Booth, I think there's one element of this movie we haven't discussed, and coming completely from the side of the sniper point of view, of not just the keeping him in a phone booth usage of his character, but his supposed looking for some social justice, from being that sniper, of being like, I want you to be a better person, Stu. I want you to come clean to the world because you are a dirty, dirty person.
Right.
This is something which, more than I think any other element of the movie, is the kind of thing which throws people off in movies, where they see it as a very hopeful element that movies throw into the real world, where even though we can understand and empathize and realize elements of this movie as things that come from our real world, the actual phone booth, the police coming in, an actual sniper doing something crazy, but the fact that the sniper wants something supposedly just in this situation just seems like a hopeful cinematic thing that people put in movies because we need a happy feeling in these films. What is it that you kind of feel when you think about this element of this movie or in other movies that come forward?
Well, the thing with the sniper is you're left to wonder so much about him. And you're left to wonder, one, what made him do that? How is he living? What, does he have a job? You know, like, what is his life? And
he's a cop.
Just in this moment, it wouldn't shock me. He exists in this moment where it's like he is, you know, he is this. He's maybe an angel. Maybe he's Stu's watch and something like he's basically us, right? And it'd be interesting. It will almost be fascinating to see this, what this movie does, because it's like, especially when they go into these other two cases, about these two other people that the sniper has killed, and it's like, one was this porn king. It's like, okay, yeah, we get that. But then one was this Wall Street dude, and it's like, this is the days right, you know, this is right around Enron time. So, this is even before, you know, the crash and the recession and all that stuff. So I can only imagine, like, this movie came out today, a lot of people with the sniper on that front. It's like, yeah, it's like, fucking take those people to task, man. Like, what would they do? Would their true colors finally come out? And Stu's true colors come out, and those true colors being that Stu in reality is a coward. And This is how the sniper is trying to make him not be a coward and own up to his flaws, which suddenly none of us do. None of us really own up to our own flaws. Why would we if we don't have to? And I like the idea of the sniper because he's left so ambiguous and you're left to question his rules. Like the thing I want to get into about the pizza guy, for example, is up until a certain point where like, this guy believes in social justice. He only kills people who deserve it. But then at the end of the movie, he kills what seems to be an innocent pizza guy to cover his tracks. And I look at that, and this is something that really gets me at the movie, and then just one of the reasons why I consider it was of such high class, is I'm left to wonder in so many ways, okay, how do I feel about the killing of this pizza guy? Because what I know about this sniper is he only hurts people who deserve it. So what if – in my head I'm like, okay, what if this pizza guy – maybe he's got to know. Find out everything else. Like it can't just be he killed the innocent pizza guy. It can't, because that's not who this sniper is based on what we know of him. It's got to be this sniper knows everything about this situation. He has planned this out for weeks. He knows how the cops are going to respond. He knows what instruments they're going to use to try and track him over the phone. He knows where to stay so he won't get seen. He knows what booth Stu is going to be at. I have to believe he picked a pizza guy that he knew would be unredeemable, that he could kill and there would be no loss to the world, or if anything, there'd be a betterment to the world. I have to believe that pizza guy was bad news, because otherwise the sniper loses everything. I think from what we, because if he's just willing to kill an innocent dude to cover his tracks, he's not the dude that he's sold to be in the other 89 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, like I have to, like, and that's the thing about a movie like this, or like something like that, is you have to matter how deep this goes. Like, I can't believe, it just doesn't other way why he would kill the pizza guy unless he already knew. And that's the thing, and the movie kind of lets you just stew on that and wonder, okay, the sniper killed the pizza guy, the sniper took Stu hostage. Like, you're left to wonder, how bad is this guy? Like, and then it kind of also makes you wonder, would I run into this guy? And it kind of makes you wonder, am I a good person in this dude's eyes? I mean, I haven't hurt anybody, but we all have secrets. Like, it's kind of, it really, this movie, I don't know, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just me. But this movie, in my mind, really gets into your head at the end. And you're like, would I run, am I a decent enough person to avoid the sniper's crosshairs? Or would I end up being the pizza guy? Where the pizza guy, I imagine, hadn't. So I imagine the pizza guy just, like, got screwed over because he was just that bad a dude. You know? Like, I don't know. But that's, but as far as the sniper goes, yeah, that's where he sits for me.
Yeah, it's that's a weird place to be at that point, because I hadn't even considered the pizza guy, because I was willing to say that the sniper wasn't a good person. I was willing to say he wasn't a good person, but at the same time, he's willing to judge others, because that seems like a real person to me.
I do think that opinion is definitely informed by, I started thinking about that until about 2 years ago. So this is well after I've established the movie as my favorite.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about this. So this is, I don't even know what viewing this is in the movie at this point, but there was one viewing recently within the last 2 years where went like, wait a minute. If he's the pizza guy and the pizza guy's innocent, the entire movie falls apart. Nothing about the movie works anymore. Because then I have no care. Because in the original, what's interesting is in the original script, if you read it by Larry Cohen, at the end of the movie, the sniper dies. He slits his throat. He kills himself. So it's like Stu. It's almost like Stu was his. It's almost like in the original script, he succeeded in not killing someone. Mm-hmm. And by succeeding, he accomplished his goal. And thus he could slit his. He was okay with slitting his throat and dying. And he gets on in the script, he gets on the phone with Catherine Ramey and gets on the phone with Stu and has this final goodbye with Stu, and then it's over. And I've read that, and I'm like, I don't think that ending would have worked. To think that, like, oh, no, there's no way. To me, a real person is, if we're talking about real people, is the sniper that suddenly succeeded for once in actually not killing someone to change them. And if you were the sniper and you were that dude, you would totally do it again. You'd be like, okay, this is how you do it. And that's how psychopaths work, because he is a psychopath.
Yeah.
Like that's how they work. They're like, oh fuck, that worked. Okay, let's do it again. They wouldn't just kill themselves because their mission is over. No. That's not at all how that shit works. So it makes sense that he's alive at the end, and it makes sense that he pinned it on the pizza guy. But in my head, I'm like, fuck. In order for this movie to keep working, how do I have to spin him? And that's the thing about movies. People put their spin on everything. You know what? You know. Dozens of people have their own spin on Inception, or their own, or taking more psychopath example, American Psycho. You know, yeah. What's your spin at the end of that movie? You know, did he do? Is it just in his head, or did he actually kill those people? Everyone in that society is just, you know, just doesn't know anyone, and just they think they do, but they don't. Same idea where it's like, okay, in my head, how do I have to spin this movie? And my spin is, and I stand by my spin because it's my spin, is the pizza guy had to be something that we don't see. Otherwise, the entire movie just falls apart. And it's just this one thing. And if you have to believe the scene plays out a certain way, we just didn't see it, where he kidnapped the pizza guy, or maybe he was holding the pizza guy hostage already, and he said, maybe if you go deliver this pizza, you'll live. Like, I have to imagine that's how it plays out.
That's entirely possible. But I think we're almost hitting the end point of this discussion here on this film, but I'm curious
about. I'm
glad
I'm discussing this, because this is going to be the last I ever say about this movie.
Oh, like, my goodness!
As far as defending it goes, like, it's not true. I'm sure I'm going to get into this conversation again. But
yeah, are you going to just? Someone's going to ask you what your favorite movie is. If you're going to say this, and they're just going to link them to this. You're going to be like, just listen to that.
Pretty much. Pretty much.
I'm tired of having this conversation.
I am tired. That's the thing, is I am, you know, it's fun to have this conversation for like a year or two. But after a while, I get to a point where, okay, you got to take it or leave it. There are some people who sort of just, they can't accept it. Like, I'll give them an explanation. And then they'll just keep wanting more.
Oh, don't worry. I had a lot of arguments about the Wolverine last year. So I know exactly the kind of things you're talking
about. Did you love the Wolverine?
I kind of loved it a lot. Like, I
enjoy it. There's definitely moments in it where I'm like, that is... Like, right after he gets his healing powers back, and the dude swipes him with the samurai sword and goes through him, and it instantly heals him in, like... half inch by half inch until as he goes through, I'm like, that is some of the best Wolverine moment. That's like one of the best Wolverine moments I've ever seen, you know.
I think it's probably the best Wolverine movie we've seen yet. That's how far I go.
There's only two, and
by the way, when I say Wolverine movie, I'm including all the first three X-Men movies, because I consider those to be Wolverine movies with friends.
Okay.
That's fair. Because I don't really want to get into that, because I've had those arguments and it hurts sometimes. I have arguments about a lot of movies that I love that my friends and my co-hosts on my other podcast, they take me to task sometimes.
What they don't realize is that by taking you to task, they're only increasing your love for it.
That is very true, and it's something that I. I've gotten to that point, and maybe it's because it's with the same people all the while, because if it was like you with Phone Booth, where it's every other person hears about this, it starts the conversation, and it kind of repeats itself. But because it's with these same people, that when it comes to that movie, there's always going to be that movie that comes up, like every 2 months or 3 months or whatever, that they take me to task on, that... Yeah. I eventually get to this point where I look at them and I ask them, are you willing to accept that I legitimately like this thing? And they're not yet ready to legitimately accept it. They just can't believe it. And it just comes off as a weird moment, you know?
I know exactly how you feel.
You get it. But anyways, I hope you know that I wasn't asking you if you legitimately asked this, like this movie. But
I don't think you care if I legitimately like it or not. You just care that I'm willing to defend it.
No, I just care that we have this conversation because I enjoy hearing these stories. But I want to ask you one thing more before we go, and it has to do with sharing this movie. Being the kind of movie that people probably had seen for one reason or another, but the idea that you might possibly be talking to someone about this movie in such a way that they could possibly recontextualize the film as being something more than the, as you say, throwaway 80-minute popcorn movie, do you ever feel like you have to share this movie on that level with someone?
God, you know, no. You know, no, I don't, because the movie is, you know, for me, movies are very personal, and TV shows too are a personal experience for me. Movie for me is not date night, you know. Movie for me is I go to the theater myself, I sit down, and I experience it, good or bad. And the same with TV shows. I don't usually actually watch a lot of things with friends. Stand-up comedy, like, I'll watch with friends, you know? But, like, movies and TV shows, for me, it's very individual, personal. I've never had I never contextualized around a social experience. So, like, if someone – like, for example, someone says to me, oh, you know what? Maybe I should go rewatch Phone Booth. I'm like, yes, please, go rewatch Phone Booth and then come back to me and we'll talk. But I never have a need to, like – or if someone says I've never seen it, I'd be like – be like it, but I'm never the guy to be like, you gotta watch this, or I'm never like, we're watching this right now, like our friend Jack Drew, right? Jack for a second.
He's been on this show.
Has he been on this show? Yeah. I didn't hear that episode. What'd he do? What
he talked about JFK.
Did he? Okay. When I was staying with him when I first went to Los Angeles, he put on The Shining, which I've never seen, and I was just and I was like, and he was like, "We're watching The Shining. You ever seen The Shining? We're watching The Shining." That's who Jack is. Like Jack wants to share his favorite movies with you. Like he did it with The Box too that same week. Richard Kelly's The Box. He loves The Box. And actually, The Box is a much better example of to Phone Booth, like much more comparison, where because that The Box is kind of like that, where it's not everyone loves The Box, like, but Jack fucking loves The Box, and he really, really wanted me to watch The Box, and so I rewatched The Box. I still kind of feel the same about it, but it's like, you know, I don't have that moment with Phone Booth or any movie I love, but if someone says to me, "Hey, do you think I should go watch this movie?" Yeah, I'll give them my thoughts. If they ever say, "You think I should watch Phone Booth?" Yes, go watch Phone Booth, and then come back, we'll talk. But I'm never like I never try to hold a friend hostage or someone hostage. Be like, "Hey, you're watching this movie. I don't care if you watch the movie or not. I know what I like." And you kind of have to feel that way when you like the things that I like as much as I do. It's just like, I like what I like. If you like it too, that's great. If you don't, oh well, maybe some other time. But I'm never going to hold someone hostage and force them to watch something. It's just not who I am.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to me, Meryl.
Thank you for having me on and letting me finally get some words on this that aren't in 140 characters a minute. Like, seriously, you can't defend a movie via Twitter. It doesn't work. Like, because, like, Twitter is 140 characters and you just can't get out everything. Like, I feel like I finally just got... And I feel like I could continue rambling about this movie, but I don't want to anymore. I'm kind of pooped on it. But because I've been thinking about what I was going to say for the last week since I rewatched it. But just I'm happy I got this out. I'm happy to be on your show. It only took me writing for Forbes and Nerdist to do it.
I was going to have you on long before that happened, sir.
Yeah. All right. I'm good.
That was the episode. As usual, I want to thank my guest Meryl for coming on the show. You can tweet at him at Meryl Barr, and make sure you just say hey and tell him you heard the show. And if you're hearing anything else out there, that's because I have my windows open while I'm recording this outro. I'm at Gman Reviews. You can hear the show over at Gman Reviews, also through iTunes and Stitcher. Feel free to go and rate, review, subscribe for the show over there, and let me know what you think. Tweet me, email me, put a comment in the post, and as always, guys, keep loving movies, because this podcast is all about that. At the end of the day, we all love movies for one reason or another, kind of movie it is, but it's just all about that love, and I'm so happy that we're expressing it this way in this show. So thanks so much for listening, and enjoy. And enjoy, and then good night. I'm gonna meet Jesus on the line.